Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Staple Inn for this Ordinary General Meeting. Copies of the minutes of the Ordinary General Meeting held on 22nd November 2004 have been displayed on the Institute Notice Board and will be taken as read. May I sign the minutes as a correct record? Thank you. I'd like to extend a particular welcome to our guests here this evening. First of all, we're delighted to welcome Sir Derek Morris, who will be addressing us in a few moments. And also in the front row, members of his review team, including Nikki Cleal, Paul Kennedy, David Hobson, and Stephen Dickinson. Also like to welcome here tonight Bob Wilcox, President of the American Academy of Actuaries, and Lauren Bloom from the American Academy of Actuaries. And finally, Paul Boyle, Chief Executive of the Financial Reporting Council. You're all very welcome, and if you want to join in our discussions this evening, you're most welcome to. And I'd also like to welcome any personal guests of members who are here today. Before the main part of the evening, we have a very pleasant opportunity for the presentation of a prize from the Worshipful Company of Actuaries. This is a prize for the best performance in Subject 404 life insurance examinations in April 2004. It's been won by Helen Jenkins, and I'd like to ask Alan Frost from the Worshipful Company to present the prize. Alan.
Thank you, President. For those of you who don't know, the livery received its letters patent from the then Lord Mayor 25 years ago this month, and our founding master was your distinguished predecessor, Geoffrey Hayward. Our prime objective within the livery is to promote a greater understanding and knowledge of the actuarial profession within the City of London. Circumstances over the last few years have not made that task particularly easy. We wish you and the profession success in deliberating on Sir Derek Morris's report and look forward to a robust and vibrant profession in the future. Our second objective is participation in the governance of the City of London. For most, that means at the very least voting for the sheriffs and the Lord Mayor. Some go further, and one of our past masters, Ken Ayres, became a sheriff some 10 years ago, the first to do so from one of the so-called modern companies. His coat of arms is on the hammer beam on the south side of the building, closest to the gallery. Our other important work is in the charitable field. The city donates some tens of millions of pounds to charities each year. Our company's contribution is a modest £60,000 or so, but for a company of our age, it is very creditable. Within that sum, we assist the Institute with prizes, and it is my pleasure to introduce you to Mrs. Helen Jenkins, whose performance in the May 2004 Diet has received special recognition. I gather in due course she's also going to receive the Byrne Prize. Helen works in Swindon with a well-known Swiss life company and is married to an actuary. Tonight, it gives me great pleasure to present her with a cheque for her results in the May 2004 life examinations. This is Helen Jenkins.
Thank you, Alan. Congratulations, Helen. We now move on to the main part of this evening's proceedings. You will all be aware of the origins of the review of the actuarial profession by Sir Derek Morris and his team. The government announced the review in March last year on the publication of the report by Lord Penrose into the affairs of equitable life, a report which contained a number of criticisms of the actuarial profession. At the outset of his review, counsel supplied Sir Derek and his team with a factual description of the profession, how it is organised, what actuaries do. Last September, we responded in writing to his consultation document with its 88 questions. And again, at that stage, our approach was primarily to supply factual answers to the questions. But we did say at that time that we would be consulting the membership of the profession in the new year. And the review has now reached a very important phase with the publication of the interim assessment. This document summarises the responses to the earlier consultation, but goes on to identify the key issues and suggest a range of options for tackling those issues. So tonight, ladies and gentlemen, is your opportunity to put your views. We are particularly looking for responses to the various options set out in the interim assessment. It would, I'm sure, be tempting for all of us to debate Chapter 1, the background, at great length. Many of us might feel that some of the criticisms are unduly harsh, although we might also agree that they contain more than a grain or two of truth. Overall, our view at Council is that the report is balanced and fair. So now is the time for us to look forward rather than backwards and raking over the coals of the past. So we, as I said before, we are particularly looking for responses to the options set out in the interim assessment. I'd now like to ask Sir Derek to introduce the discussion. Sir Derek.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Can I first check that everyone can hear, particularly those right at the back?
Yep.
Thank you. I will stay sitting because if I stand, I will be a long way from the microphone. Let me start by saying I am very pleased to be here. I'm grateful for the opportunity to meet with the Institute and discuss the issues that I set out in my interim assessment in December. I'm gratified that such a large number of you have turned up tonight. You know, was it something I said? Seems the appropriate comment. So I said to the group that I saw in the faculty in Glasgow, if you have come here to throw things, I would prefer flowers or money. I'd like to thank also all of those who contributed to the interim report, and I know some of those people are here tonight. We had over 100 written responses, but also I and my team, most of whom are here tonight, had a large number of meetings with all manner of interested parties, and that's also been very helpful. I hope you've all had a chance to look at the interim assessment. It highlighted a number of issues, a number of challenges, and a number of options. It included, it is true to say, some critical comments, and of course the press, being the press, highlighted those. So just before I get going with a bit of a thumbnail summary of the main points as a background to your giving me your views on it, let me just stress some positive points. The first is this: this review is not about the skill and professionalism of actuaries. And I would quote, though I hope you've all read it, one sentence from the introduction. No evidence has been received in the course of this review to suggest that the overwhelming majority of actuaries in the UK are anything other than dedicated, skilled professionals providing important and useful advice to the best of their abilities with commitment, integrity and a strong sense of professional duty. That is what I found, and I think it's important to stress that right at the beginning. And also, for those prepared to read the report in detail, I hope it dispels a number of what I can only describe as rather facile, wise after the event criticisms that some others have made of the actuarial profession, a sort of belief that somehow actuaries should be able to foretell the future with complete accuracy often appears in some of the press criticism and is of course not valid. In particular, the report identifies a whole range of factors, a whole range of contributors to the current long-term savings problem. I do not say that actuaries have no role in that, but the notion that somehow the long-term savings problem, the demise of many defined benefit schemes, is somehow solely the result of actuarial failures, seems to me clearly false. Another positive point is that I do believe the profession itself may share much of the analysis, not every last bit of it perhaps, but much of the analysis of the problems identified in the interim report. It's clearly, the profession that is clearly seeking to move forward and in a constructive manner, and I think that is all positive. I do hope, and I mean this very, very genuinely, that this review will prove helpful to the profession as it seeks to move forward. So this meeting is an opportunity for you to provide comments on a number of issues, possible ways forward, costs and benefits of some of the options there, and all of that I and my team will be noting before we seek to move towards finalising our investigation. As I think you probably know, detailed written comments, which I do urge you to send in, are needed to a very tight time scale by Friday the 4th of February. The interim report was structured around three main areas. One was to do with regulation in its broadest sense, and the other two were to do with competition for actuarial services, and the third was to do with the government's actuarial department. I'm going to mainly focus on the first of those. If there's time, we might move on to the second, but the main area I want to talk to and hear from the profession about is the regulatory side. I'm going to kick off with one broad overarching issue in relation to regulation and then briefly mention five specifics, and then I'll hand over to you to comment either on the broad areas or the specifics as you think fit. On the broad area, one has to be clear from the start about the objectives of regulation of any profession. And then secondly, one needs to think about what broad types of regulation are appropriate. On the first of those, the objectives of regulation, let me try to summarise this very quickly in terms of two propositions. The first is that actuarial advice and expertise is absolutely critical in a number of areas. It has far-reaching consequences if that advice is either not obtained or it's not adequate and if it's ignored. Inevitably, therefore, there are public interest concerns to ensure that it is obtained, it is adhered to, and it is delivered to a very high standard. The second proposition is that such advice is, unfortunately, complex. It is difficult, and users, particularly trustees and non-execs in life companies and others, frankly, are often not equipped to evaluate the advice that they are given. I go further. I think many have profound difficulty in understanding some of the concepts and the ideas that they need to understand in this area. I'm even tempted to say that I think the public at large very much react against understanding or accepting that they face significant financial risk and uncertainty. There is, I think, strong resistance to them acknowledging that, and that's unfortunate. It's what we call in the report, for want of a shorthand, an understanding gap as between what you understand and need to tell them and what they are, in a sense, psychologically prepared to comprehend. So from those two propositions, I infer that users are actually very, very reliant on actuaries, but they have difficulty in evaluating their services. There is, I think, has been limited scrutiny in the past, though that's changing, and limited market testing of actuarial advice. And if you put that set of circumstances together, I think one does end up concluding that there is a need for a robust, though one hopes not too intrusive, regulatory framework. So the objectives are essentially, one, to ensure that appropriate actuarial input is obtained. Second, to protect public interest concerns, provided that phrase, public interest, can be given clear and enforceable expression. And third, to ensure that appropriate professional and ethical standards of conduct are maintained. I hope none of that is particularly controversial. In the light of those comments, the review considers three broad models, if you like, three broad types of regulation. One, continued self-regulation. Two, independent oversight of self-regulation. And three, full statutory regulation by an independent regulator or regulators. And the interim view is, I hope, clear, that self-regulation is difficult, that it has probably not in the past been sufficient, or at least not as successful as one could want, and many here perhaps would have hoped. And given recent events, it will, I think, be difficult to engender full public confidence in continued self-regulation. However, full statutory regulation seems to me almost certainly to be disproportionate. I've said how critical the actuarial profession is, but it's a small profession, and I think a full statutory regime may well be too costly. Perhaps more important than that, I think it would seriously risk losing the input and the enthusiasm of practitioners. And no regulatory regime is going to be effective without that. And therefore, I'm rather sceptical, I have to say, despite the calls for this from some quarters, for a full statutory regime of regulation. And that is what leads me at the moment to a preference for the intermediate regime. That is, continuing self-regulation subject to independent oversight. I note, though it has not really been part of my thinking, but I just note in passing that that type of model is what has emerged in the accountancy profession. I think it is also emerging currently in the legal profession, and therefore I take some comfort from the fact that there may be certain underlying, if you like, characteristics of a profession that lead to this being a sensible model. But if that's right, it raises an immediate question: who should exercise that independent oversight? One could, of course, think of a new body with representatives from the profession on it, from regulators, from government, from users, and so on. One could design such a model. But I wonder about the justification for that in terms of regulatory intervention and cost. And I do look at the model that has emerged under the, in relation to the accountancy profession in the Financial Reporting Council, as a way forward. Indeed, I'm sufficiently attracted by that to suggest that not just as a model, but that one might actually use the FRC as the independent oversight body. It currently provides independent oversight of professional accountancy bodies. It provides statutory oversight and regulation in relation to auditors. It sets, it monitors and enforces accounting and auditing standards, or at least has oversight of that. And I can see some synergies and some cost savings in having a similar sort of structure, institutional structure, applied to actuaries. But that is one key question on which I would seek your comments. Let me then go on to, and more briefly, the five particular areas in which I would very much welcome your views. The first is on actuarial roles, and in particular, whether there should continue to be reserved roles. And my current view, I hope, is quite clear. I think that the service, the function that actuaries play and provide in life business and pensions business is so important that it is vital to maintain a reserved role. That proposition needed to be tested, because creating reserve roles is quite a restriction. It gives quite a favoured position, and it should not be done lightly. But it does seem to me it is important to continue that. It brings with it the associated professional standards that go with the actuarial work. It brings public interest duties, provided those can be specified clearly, and it brings with it the disciplinary side, disciplinary work of the profession with it. So despite, again, some opposition, I feel myself reasonably confident that that should continue. In which case, the really big issue under this first heading is to do with general insurance, where there is not, outside Lloyd's anyway, there is not currently a reserved role. And here the argument has been quite intense. To summarise it quickly, there is argument stemming from, for example, the HIH experience in Australia, where there wasn't a reserved role, and significant problems emerged, and the investigation into that in Australia recommended that as a result there should be a reserved role, and there now is, in general insurance. And one could argue this could just as easily happen, indeed, in one or two cases to some extent has happened in the UK, so should we not shore up that side of things by having, for the same sorts of reasons we have it in life and pensions, have a reserved role in general insurance. The alternative argument is that things seem to be going moderately well in the UK on that front, that actuaries are used as and when needed by general insurance companies, and that in any event, if there is a reserved role, it should be to do with long-term liabilities. But in general insurance, splitting that off as to what constitutes long-term liabilities as opposed to a large swathe of short-term liability business might be quite difficult. So there is a big question there as to whether reserve roles should be extended into general insurance. Let me mention then one specific problem that stems from reserved roles, and that's to do with scheme actuaries, and that's the conflict of interest issue. It's been put to me, and I'm sure it's true, that for many years scheme actuaries have provided what one might call an honest broker role, as between their duties to trustees, to whom they are actually responsible, and also sponsor companies. With the much greater pressure that now exists because of what's happened to inflation, interest rates, the stock market and so on, I'm not myself at all persuaded that actuaries can continue to bear that honest broker role. It seems to me the potential conflict between trustees and sponsor companies may well just simply be too great. If I were to caricature it, simply one wants lower contributions and the other wants higher contributions. How to solve that? Superficially, you might say, well, there has to be two actuaries. There has to be a scheme actuary reporting to the trustees, and there has to be a separate actuary for the sponsor company. There's a very obvious drawback to that proposal, which is that it is likely to be very costly, and in many cases, neither the company nor the trustees may feel that they need to have their own separate actuaries. So what I've been looking at, and again I'd welcome views on this, is some intermediate way of dealing with this, a way in which, for example, but this is only one example, that the scheme actuary be fully responsible to trustees, as at present. Provided the trustee agrees, then both the assumptions and the data and the information of the scheme actuary can be made available to the sponsor company. But if at any point the trustees feel that there is a conflict of interest that they regard as too great, then at their discretion they cut off that link, and at that point they would say to the company, you must at this point now find your own actuarial advice. Now, that also raises wider issues about whether there are conflicts of interest actually on as between the company and the trustees, and what is the composition of the scheme trustees. That goes a bit beyond my particular remit, but is clearly relevant. And there may be other ways of dealing with this, but what one needs is some way of ensuring that where any type of conflict of interest issue does arise, that then one can separate out and give clear accountability to the two sides. If I move on quickly, the second issue is much more general issue of public interest and accountability. And you will see from the report this is a very difficult area. There's a lot of detail to do with first life and then pensions here, but in order just to be quick, I just want to look at the overarching issue. Some of the evidence we have received argues quite clearly that there should be no wider responsibility on actuaries than that to the client who employs them. Given the character of actuarial services, as I've summarised it earlier, I'm not persuaded that that's a sustainable position. If that's correct, then the review's approach can be summarised, again to be brief, in four propositions. For those of you who have the report here, it's summarised on page 79, paragraph 555. First, there will inevitably be multiple lines of accountability. I'd suggest that what actuaries do means that that cannot be avoided. But if that's true, then it's essential that those different multiple accountabilities must be clear. It must be clear to whom they exist, for what, and where they conflict. There must be a clear set of rules to determine the hierarchy of responsibilities. The third proposition, then, is that there must be very clear guidance on how those multiple accountabilities are discharged. That must be through rules, through guidance, through reporting responsibilities, and to some degree through whistleblowing responsibilities. But there must be clear guidance on how these multiple accountabilities are discharged. And the fourth proposition is that there must be very clear incentives for people to operate within that structure. And certainly in relation to whistleblowings, there must be very clear protections and immunities if people are to operate through that scheme. So that's another very important area in which I would welcome views. The third is on education and CPD. There is, of course, a new syllabus coming in. It's generally been welcomed, I think, by respondents to my review. But some concerns remain about the setting of exams and about review and monitoring of the system, about the exam structure, in particular about the work-based format, the time taken, the reliance on training within the actuarial firms that do this, concerns about the development of, as it were, house priorities and house styles, and the lack of a vibrant, independent, presumably university-based, training or research sector. A number have commented favourably on the Australian model, which is heavily university-based. There's competition in methods of delivery between different universities. And in particular, it seems as if, but tell me if people here disagree, that broader influences can operate within the Australian system. It certainly seems to develop broader career structures, more roles for actuaries in more areas in banking, in healthcare, in more aspects of investment and so on. So I think there might be something to be learnt there in terms of broadening what actuaries do and the number of roles that they can then subsequently play. On CPD, the profession has developed a set of proposals already. We summarise them on page 119, and we're certainly trying to work with the grain of those. And I suspect we might suggest some tweaks, but not a major revision of those. Although there is, I think, a question about whether we wish to have some independent oversight of the education and CPD roles. So that's the third area. Just two to go and then I'll stop. Standard setting. Setting high quality and continuously developing standards is critical, I think, to any profession, and I doubt anyone here would dispute that in relation to actuaries. But a number of problems have been identified and put to the review, that to some extent professional standards have been too weak or ambiguous, and in that sense don't actually allow the critical role of standards, which is to allow for standardisation, to allow people to know that they are conforming in what they do with a standardised approach. It has been suggested that some contentious issues have just remained unresolved, that there's not complete consistency across different practice areas, and possibly some perceived conflicts of interest have come into the process. Again, I want to work very much with the grain of the profession, and as you know, they are proposing an actuarial standards board, and I think that's the right way to go. This will set standards, it will monitor them, it will revise and update them. If that is the way to go, I think it raises for us and for you tonight three key questions. What would be the composition of such a board? To whom would it be accountable? And that, of course, might well be within the FRC structure. And, of course, equally important, how would it be funded? We could perhaps look at the funding of the Accountancy Standard Board as a possible model, but there may be other ways. And finally on this, scrutiny and discipline. I don't know whether this would be agreed here tonight, but generally it's been put to me that scrutiny, or should I say lack of scrutiny, has been seen as quite a recurring problem in the actuarial profession. And there are a number of solutions for that if it is a problem. Better informed users, perhaps more choice, though in general the review suggests that there's quite a lot of choice amongst actuarial providers, but perhaps more market testing is required. Maybe enhanced regulatory supervision, I'm not sure. More scrutiny, though, within the profession, that seems to me to be the key ingredient here. Through audit, some of that's coming in, of course, on the life side through the FSA's changes, but more audit, I think more role for internal peer review, though a lot of that does go on, perhaps more role for external peer review, but I do want to make sure there isn't duplication, needless duplication, between audit roles being developed on the one hand and external peer review being developed on the other. I won't go through the specific proposals. They're on life, they're on page 142, and on pensions, they're on page 145. But it seems to me more needs to be done in that area. Again, I think the profession would probably accept that. And finally, just briefly to mention on discipline, of course, the profession has got some major proposed changes there. Again, I want to work with the grain of those. Again, there may be a role for independent oversight of the process. So I'm sorry, well, it's been about half an hour. I hope that's enough from me to give you as clear a summary view of my thinking at the moment. Nothing is written in stone. I'd welcome your views on anything that I've mentioned. If there's time at the end, I might just say a little about competition and about Government Actuarial Department. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sir Derek. Well, the discussion is now open. It would help me in managing the course of the flow of the evening if I could just have a preliminary indication of those people who think they might want to say something. That doesn't preclude you from saying something if you don't put up your hand, nor does it require you to say something if you do put up your hand. But could you put up your hand if you think you're going to want to say something? Right. You will also notice that we've dispensed with the lectern tonight. That was because we thought we were going to get dozens and dozens of people who wanted to speak, and we thought it would speed things up. So what we have got is five roving mics around here, four downstairs and one upstairs. So if anybody, when it comes to speaking, if you can let us know, and we'll get a roving mic to you very quickly, which will hopefully speed things up. Could you state your name clearly before you start speaking, because we are, as usual, recording the proceedings, and that helps us to know who's making the comments. And all speakers will be given the opportunity to review their comments before they appear in writing in the BAJ. If we do find that people don't have time to make their comments, could they could please submit them to us in writing, because we will take them on board. Okay, in that case we'll make a start. I have a short list of people here who said they wanted to speak, and I recognised most of them when the hands went up. But could I start with Stephen Yeo? Just stay there, Steve.
My name is Stephen Yeo. I want to talk about user apathy, bundling of services, and crying wolf. To me, the most significant remark in the interim assessment is in paragraph 2.4, where it is noted that, and I quote, few responses reflected the views of key users of those actuarial services. As a result, the review consulted three key user groups in more detail: occupational pension scheme trustees, the firm sponsoring such schemes, and insurance company non-executive directors, end quote. The review does go on to identify an understanding gap between the expertise of those receiving advice and the detailed and technical nature of the subject on which advice is being given. It discusses steps that could be taken to close this understanding gap. But to me, the lack of response to the consultation speaks volumes about the gap. Maybe the lack of response is an indication of consultation fatigue. There's certainly been plenty of food for fatigue in the past. But I think it shows more than this. I think the users of our advice have been too happy to sit back and say, the actuary knows best, and maybe we have too. The feedback that was obtained from users was very important. It says that in the review. And unfortunately, it was obtained on a confidential basis. As a result, we have a consultation process that is very transparent. I counted 77 responses on the website, but only transparent in parts, and it is the opaque parts that are of interest, and I think that is unfortunate. Second, I want to say a few words about bundling. The first consultation contained 88 questions, of which just two related to investment. However, by the time the questionnaire to 15 large consulting firms was issued on the 7th of September, bundling of investment services for pension scheme clients was obviously at the centre of the review team's mind. In the question about joint service provision, no fewer than three of the five services listed were investment related. Note that the 7th of September was long before the deadline for responses to the consultation, but something, or perhaps somebody, had definitely happened to cause this change of emphasis. Now, I'm no expert in competition, but having observed the pension scheme consultancy market for a few decades, it seems to me it's a simple matter to change the source of investment advice. It could be done overnight. But the administration of pension benefits, which is often also provided by actuarial firms, is much harder to change. If a bundled actuarial and administration service is provided, it would be a very hard task to change the advisor. By focusing on investment advice rather than administration services, it seems that the review team are rather more interested in, quotes, our excessive influence, as it says in paragraph 2.26, than they are in competition. Third, on crying wolf, the review team is kind enough to note, although very briefly in paragraph 1.38, that some actuaries did offer advice on the basis of share prices being too high. I was pleased to see this because I had turned up a press report by Barry Riley, possibly the leading press commentator on pensions matters in the 1990s, after he had read a paper submitted in this hall to the Staple Inn Society in March 1999, maybe even 2000 actually, entitled Pension Schemes and Low Inflation. Some of you may remember it. He says that only a profession as gloomy as we are could see bad news in high investment returns and greater longevity. He concludes a very long article by saying, the actuaries have cried wolf too often. Their cautious projections over the years have been left stranded by booming investment markets. And we've since been criticised by, in parts in this review and also in the Turner review, for not anticipating changes that have occurred. So now we are learning it's not that we cried wolf too much, but we didn't do it enough. And we mustn't make this mistake again.
Norman Freethy? Is Norman here? It's coming this way.
Mr. President, Sir Derek, we're indebted to you and your team, Sir Derek, for this opportunity to take a thorough look at ourselves, which may not otherwise have come our way, and we're grateful, I'm sure, for all the effort that you've all put in on our behalf. Now, there's much in this review which looks as if it could result in increasing regulation and restrictions on our modus operandi, and which, if we're not careful, might succeed only in killing off whatever creative flair our insular souls might still have. So I'm glad that Sir Derek will look on the positive side in reviewing the role of actuaries and concentrate on how our qualities can best be harnessed as a force for public good.
Mm-hmm.
He sees potential for conflict, as he referred to a short while ago, where the pension scheme actuary also advises the scheme sponsor. Although I'm now mainly retired, I act as an independent trustee of schemes where once I was the appointed actuary. One of these comprises a large majority of pensioners and deferreds made redundant when their original company was recently taken over. The scheme actuary has for many years also advised the company and has acquiesced in a minimum MFR funding basis. Now, his fees are met ultimately by the company, so it is unlikely he would take a stance which is significantly against that company's interests. There is clear potential for conflict. The large group of retired and deferred members I've referred to are effectively orphaned, with no one to speak directly on their behalf, and it is in this type of situation that separate advisors to the trustees and the company become very necessary. Now, handled in the right way, I think Sir Derek's misgivings that this adds significantly to the overall administration expense need not necessarily be borne out. The data need only be processed, need not be processed by each side. One could take the other side's sums and just put their interpretation on it. We are encouraging member-nominated trustees, but despite the hopes pinned on them by poor miners and the government, these people are not and cannot overnight at least become pensions experts, yet they assume massive responsibilities. Also, they owe their livelihood to their employer and must naturally think carefully before taking a stance against him. Another conflict. It is in this increasingly common type of situation that the presence of an independent trustee who is a professional with many years' experience in pensions is not beholden to the company and can exercise real influence. He can keep the scheme actuary on his toes, that's for sure, and he can also imbue members' trustees with more confidence to speak up on behalf of their members. Actuaries are particularly well qualified, I would suggest, for such a role, and in his review, I would hope Sir Derek may investigate ways in which our ability to contribute thus can perhaps be enhanced. The review lays stress on competition and that tasks we currently carry out could perhaps be equally well performed by others. Now, competition is healthy, and we should welcome this, with the proviso that whoever carries out a particular task has the necessary experience and the technical expertise to do so. So, who should value the assets? Well, for the purposes of carrying out an actuarial valuation, the value attaching to the assets must relate to the value the actuary has placed on the liabilities, and any other method of valuing them risks undermining the validity of the valuation. For other purposes, the field is open to competition. Who should determine asset allocation? Again, the technical profile of the liabilities is the prime determinant of asset allocation. This is squarely in the actuary's domain and is indeed integrated with the valuation process, so the opinions of others must be viewed in that light. Our examinations, Sir Derek, were amongst the first to incorporate finance and investment in the syllabus, so we can lay claim to specific expertise in this area. Seems to me it may be counterproductive to hint that people other than actuaries should be permitted to carry out certain tasks without specifying who are able and qualified to perform such duties. So it is to be hoped that the final report will spell out precisely who it is envisaged are these alternatives to actuaries and in what circumstances. Otherwise, the competence and the confidence of the profession may be undermined to no avail. Sorry about this slow turnover of pages. I think the elector may have paid off, President. Finally, on the question of regulation, it can only be to the profession's benefit to be answerable to an independent overseeing body. I think no one would disagree with this. But this body, in my view, should comprise not merely high-profile and competent lay members, but consist also of at least, say, two senior actuaries, so that there is interplay at the highest regulatory level. I do not think it is appropriate for such a body to be the same as that which regulates the accountancy profession, as this would open the door for us to be judged by standards appropriate to another profession, and in extremis to become a small subset of the accountants. In reality, we are totally independent and in most respects perform quite different functions. Thank you.
Trevor Lanwan. Is Trevor here?
Thank you. I wish to talk about the public interest in the context of reserved roles. I see this as being about the governance and the requirements relating to the way actuaries work. So fundamentally, I think we have to address conflicts of interest, threats to independence, and unclear certifications. Getting the public interest served in this way is essential for preserving the long-term reputation of actuaries, so necessary, in my view, for the future careers of our younger actuaries and students. So I wish to focus on two examples in my area of pensions, where I think before coming along tonight, I was wondering if we were going to duck the issue or not. Maybe we're not. But let me go through them as I see them. First, advice to employer and advice to the trustees. There are some instances where conflicts can and do arise. Quite often, this is not the case, with the interests of both parties being aligned. But this is not true all the time. I don't think, therefore, we can accept as a profession a do-nothing outcome on the basis that costs will double. In fact, far from it. That won't happen, and for reasons that Norman was just saying before me, for example. But instead, we must say what is the best way to remove such conflicts cost-effectively and pragmatically. To use higher costs as a reason for preserving the status quo and not protecting third parties, i.e. the members, is akin, in my view, to saying cars can run without third-party car insurance because the cost of insurance is too high to make it compulsory. I don't think we can go down that route. Secondly, the financial statements for pension schemes. The original consultation graphically talked about two legs of the same pair of trousers being examined separately without anyone checking the overall fit. Can we as actuaries continue to support, as being in the public interest, the lack of an overall certification of fit? I think that once again we should accept some change here and find the cost-effective way to do it. We can't duck it. Life companies can sort this out, and they do have certification of the overall fit, so why can't we on pensions? So I would urge us all to accept that we should be addressing conflicts of interest, threats to independence, and unclear certifications. This is not about outright bans. It's about deciding the limitations and the checks and being cost effective. For the sake of the careers of our younger actuaries, we, in my view, cannot duck this on short term cost grounds. Thank you.
Thank you. Paul Thornton.
Thank you. Paul Thornton. I think this is a very helpful review to us in thinking about our role in society, so I certainly welcome it. I also welcome the analysis of the conflicts of interest for the pension scheme actuary, and I rather agree with Stephen Yeo that we need to know what the views are of the scheme trustees and employers that we advise. And I hope that in response to the interim review, many of our clients will express their views to the review team. I think we have to bear in mind that pension schemes are a joint venture. They're set up on the back of the economic activity of the employer, and the trust vehicle is used. It's been encouraged by the tax system in this country for many years. But the trustee bodies typically include member representation and employer representation, with plenty of trustees wearing multiple hats. And it's in that context, I think, that historically the same actuary advising the scheme, i.e. the trustees and the employer, was considered acceptable. Now, times change, and that clearly is no longer regarded as acceptable. So it's very helpful, I think, to have mapped out for us the options. An approach which would seem to me to be acceptable, and I'm not sure if it's a variation of option two or option four, is the one where the scheme actuary advises the trustees. He has a calculation team, and another actuary in the same firm advises the employer, drawing on the services of the same calculation team. Now, in most cases, that works fine. If there's a serious conflict, then the scheme trustee or the employer is likely to want different firms to advise them, but it's relatively easy to move from that structure to separate firms or second opinions. So that's an approach which my firm has been moving towards, for certainly for new appointments, and historically has had for some old appointments, and in practice seems to have worked pretty well and dealt with the conflict situation. I'd also just like to comment on the section on the market, competition and so on. There's a bit of an attack on full service provision, which is slightly surprising to me, given that this has been driven by client requirements as much as firms wishing to develop the scale of their businesses. Particularly in the area of strategic investment advice, I think there's considerable logic for linking strategic investment advice to the funding advice. In fact, the issues can't really be separated. And I think we need to remember again the historic context. Actuaries became involved in investment work through working in life offices, where they became involved in life office fund management. And then the stockbroking firms felt they needed to have some actuaries to deal with these boffins and the clients. And so actuaries got involved in stockbroking. And then some of those actuaries thought it would be a good idea to have the Financial Times indices and helped create those. Then on the back of that, other actuaries thought it would be a good idea to measure the performance of funds, particularly pension funds. And on the back of that, we got into manager selection pioneered asset liability management. And hence it is that we are currently involved in giving strategic investment advice. So I think there's a good deal of historical involvement of actuaries in investment work. Now, it's certainly true that in this day and age, actuaries aren't the only possible advisors on investment matters. But I would argue that the profession has a unique position of relating assets to liabilities, which many of those other potential advisors don't. The challenge for the profession is to be best in class, if one puts it that way, and to actually be as good as anybody else in terms of adding something to managing risk of pension and other liabilities. I quite agree that manager research could be dealt with by people that are quite separate from actuarial firms, but in practice there are barriers to entry, and there aren't many other firms that have thought it was sufficiently profitable to get involved in it. Now, the profession has been keen to encourage other professionals to be part of the wider actuarial profession through a scheme of affiliate membership. And I think it's important here to remember that membership of a professional body brings with it the possibility that users of services can rely on standards of competence and so on. So I think we should be giving the actuarial profession encouragement to include within its general umbrella other investment professionals. This would parallel, actually, what's been going on within the actuarial consulting firms, in which both actuaries and non-actuaries are increasingly working alongside each other. And again, in my own firm, within our investment practice, it's only half of the people are actuaries, and the others have typically come from a fund management background before joining us. The final comment I'd just like to make is I'm delighted to see the support that the review gives to the changes in the education approach. And just in response to the comments in section 679, I think the profession's university initiative has been trying to encourage some of the top universities from which we were in practice recruiting the largest proportion of graduates to develop actuarial courses within mathematics or statistics or other degrees. I think this is an essential element of getting the universities involved, providing future actuaries with the broader education that they need. Personally, I think it's been clear for some time that learning on the job has been a bit of a trap for the profession, making it more difficult for us to think outside the traditional mainstream. But I think the interim report doesn't quite give credit to the encouragement that we've given to some of the other universities, not providing actuarial science courses as such, but actuarial modules within other degree courses. Thank you.
Thank you. Seamus Cruden.
President, ladies and gentlemen, can you hear me? I want to contribute to discussion of the Morris Review analysis, mainly but not exclusively, from my perspective as Treasurer of the Institute. In that capacity, I've inherited from my predecessors the charge that the professional body should seek to add value for all its members, present and future, that the benefits derived from membership should be good value for the subscriptions and other fees paid. I do have a real concern that this may be difficult to achieve in the post-Morris world. Let me make it clear, however, that I do not regard Sir Derek and his team as mainly responsible for this difficulty. I believe the challenge is principally to actuaries, to the Institute, to the faculty themselves. And the actuaries I most respect recognise this. Sir Derek and his team hint at some relevant issues in sections 3.1 to 3.9 of their analysis. And he expanded on the challenge we face in his interview with the actuary, which has been on the website and which will be landing on desktops and doormats later this week. I believe the Morris diagnosis is broadly accurate, and I believe that the theme of replacing self-regulation with independent external oversight is appropriate to the context for a modern profession. My main message to all of us here this evening is that this should be in parallel with a reconsideration of the objectives, governance, and operations of the professional body to fit with the circumstances of the 21st century rather than the 19th. Any illusion that incremental change to institute and faculty objectives, governance, and operations will, in my view, possibly lead to our disappearance as an independent profession. The opportunity which presents itself in the short term is for the professional bodies, with, I hope, the support of the great majority of members, to work with the Morris team, with the Financial Reporting Council, and with Her Majesty's Treasury, to make changes to our charter, to our structures, to how we use the financial and intellectual resources which come to us from our own members, so as to re-establish the profession, including an oversight framework, as a confident, vibrant, innovative component of a competitive UK service sector in a globalised marketplace. On this basis, I can honestly feel that I, and my many successors into the future as treasurers, can persuade present and future members that your subscription is worth paying. I content myself with just a few ideas on how we might reinvent the profession in the modern era. A single body for the UK, with, I suggest, a devolved body in Scotland, which, at the risk of bias, might learn some lessons from its Irish counterpart. A modern governance structure, embracing input from practitioners on a consultative basis, but with lean and focused decision-making structures led by individuals with a democratic mandate for positive change. A primary emphasis for the professional body on scientific innovation and lifelong education and development in close partnership with the universities and with international and UK counterparts in the risk management field. The emphasis should be primarily on development of knowledge and techniques, combining statistical, financial, economic, and other methodologies, but capable of broad application, rather than our current primary emphasis on the field of application, be it life, pensions, general insurance or whatever. I envisage an arm's length but constructive and I suspect dynamically developing relationship with the oversight body in relation to the broadly regulatory activities which have been the main focus of the Morris Review. And finally, closer to home, I envisage subscription and fee arrangements and new funding arrangements for various classes of member and stakeholder which fairly reflect costs and value, including the fact that already approximately 2 million of our costs are associated with the members who are acting in reserved roles. The UK, since the Industrial Revolution, has been at the forefront of development in financial security arrangements. And the UK has been a leader in global banking and capital markets developments and in the associated risk management technique developments since the 1970s. A modernised actuarial professional body following this review can make a very significant contribution to extending this lead.
Thank you, Seamus. David Martin.
My name is David Martin. Mr. President, I'd like to make some observations on revalidation of professional competence and CPD. These relate to Chapter 6 of the interim assessment. I'm speaking, first of all, as chairman of the Professional Competence Task Force, the PCTF, that was set up by the profession some time ago to address these issues. I'd like to refer in particular to the options set out in Section 6.124 and 6.140 of the interim assessment. I was pleased to read in Section 6.144 that Sir Derek would welcome a dialogue with the PCTF, and a meeting has in fact already been set up between representatives of the task force and the Morris Review team later this week. But I do have one or two comments this evening. And lastly, I have some personal views on the CPD scheme. The task force made recommendations to the profession, which Sir Derek refers to in Section 6.140, option 1. The task force has consulted with the membership about its recommendations and has met to reconsider the feedback from members. Both the consultation and the review of it occurred before the publication of the interim assessment. The two issues that were most relevant, that are most relevant this evening, that caused most comment in that consultation were the working actuaries as defined in the proposals and CPD generally. With regard to working actuaries, most concern surrounded those working in non-traditional fields or what many of us consider to be wider fields. And their objection was to compulsory CPD and concerns that they might be prevented from using the designatory letters FIA and FFA if not a working actuary as we defined it. Some respondents working outside traditional areas indicated that if the proposals were adopted that they would resign from the profession. And this clearly conflicts with the profession's policy of expanding into other fields, which is a policy with which Sir Derek concurs. Before seeing the interim assessment, the PCTF developed an alternative approach which will be considered within the profession alongside the original proposal. And under this alternative approach, those actuaries whose work is within the scope of our present guidance notes should be required to hold a practicing certificate, which in the case of reserved roles, as described by Sir Derek, would be similar to the present statutory practicing certificates. To obtain one of these two different kinds of certificate, the actuary would have to demonstrate relevant experience to have passed or deemed to have passed the regulatory module and to have the relevant CPD. The PCTF suggests that those actuaries should be referred to as practicing actuaries. Other actuaries who are still working would not require, under this alternative, a practicing certificate, but would be strongly encouraged to complete a CPD program relevant to their work. And they would be referred to not as practicing actuaries, but as actuaries, perhaps with a capital A. That approach requires less compulsion than the original recommendation, which is option one. And options two and three seem to require even more compulsion than option one. And the main concerns that I have with all three options in Section 6140 is that they may lead to those actuaries not in reserve roles resigning as actuaries so that they can compete with non-actuaries doing similar roles who do not need to meet the same requirements. This, I think, is a special case of a wider dilemma of making compulsory requirements, CPD or any other, on actuaries whose non-actuary competitors are free from those requirements. The PCTF would like to work with the Morris Review to find an option that keeps as many non-statutory role actuaries in the profession as possible. As regards CPD, the scheme came in for some criticism in our consultation. There were objections to the tick box mentality, and some questioned certain aspects of the rules. But it was apparent from the consultation exercise that not all actuaries, in particular those in non-traditional roles, understood the programme. The separate CPD committee are reviewing that scheme, and it's for that committee to come up with proposals in the light of the changes that are finally implemented. But my personal view, formed while taking part in the task force, is that the focus in future should be less on counting the number of hours at meetings and more about demonstrating continuous learning by various means in subjects that are actually relevant to the work that the actuary is doing. I understand that the accountants are close to introducing something similar. The more relevant the CPD is seen to be by us, the members of the profession, the more likely we are to accept that making it compulsory is no big deal and, in fact, distinguishes us from non-actuarial competition. Looking at the options in 6124, all four of them seem to me to be very good, and they don't seem to me to be mutually exclusive. And I think in there we have a way forward for the future. Thank you.
Chris Norden.
I'm Chris Norden. I'd like also to congratulate Sir Derek and his team on what is, I think, generally a very fair and balanced interim report. However, I do have two principal concerns from my perspective as a pensions actuary. Firstly, I am very concerned at what looks like some spin that the Treasury seemed to put on the report in its press release. There was some mention of press reports earlier, but I think the Treasury's own press release back in December was a little bit spinned. And the report by Paul Miners, which was published simultaneously on the Treasury website, does give the impression that the government has got it in for actuarial firms somewhat. I note that the government made no public submissions to the view, but can Sir Derek tell us what private comments and influence it brought to bear? The government certainly has a lot to answer for in the current pensions and saving crisis, and actuaries should not be expected to take too much of the flak. For example, remarks that actuaries were too insular and didn't challenge prevailing views and assumptions as to equity outperformance have to be considered in the context of a government which refused to accept the profession's proposals for a bond-based MFR and which initiated the Miners Review, which, as far as I can recall, was set to encourage pension funds to invest less in bonds. My second concern with the interim report is that I think there's too little emphasis on what is the appropriate role of the pensions actuary. There's little point in us discussing how we should be regulated and so on until we are clear what our role is. And I think this is particularly fundamental to any discussion of conflicts of interest when advising both trustees and employers. My experience is that the traditional bundling, if we can call it that, of trustee and employer advice is becoming a much more important issue to many clients than the so-called bundling of actuarial and investment advice, which both Sir Derek Morris and Paul Miners seem, in my view, excessively concerned about. Thank you.
Sir Derek, did you want to not tell us what the Treasury said to you, but did you want to... We've had a number of comments on conflicts of interest. Did you want to respond at this stage, or do you want to wait till the end?
Well, shall I just... Should I just pick up the point about the Treasury? As I said in this hall a while ago, some months ago, this is an independent review. I made it clear when I was asked to conduct this review that it would be independent. And as I said previously in this hall, if the government hadn't wanted an independent review, they would not have recruited someone who had previously been chairman of the Competition Commission, which operates entirely independently. So I can assure you, first, everything in the review reflects the work of the review team, not the Treasury, and I have had no inputs at all from the Treasury into the report. Second, on the press release, we, perhaps unwisely in retrospect, I don't know, but we needed someone to link us to the press, and we had a Treasury press officer, and I can assure you that the content of the press release was entirely mine and approved by me. The only thing that the Treasury changed, this is a confidential point, was the ordering of some of the points in the press release. So largely, I think your fears can be, I hope, assuaged there. But there may have been an element of the press release looking a little blacker for actuaries than I hope is the case in the report. Does that satisfy you on the... well, clearly, if the profession feels it needs to be forewarned of that, then it must act accordingly. But I can absolutely assure you that up to this moment, and indeed up to the final report, the review will reflect the review's teams, not the Treasury teams, not the Treasury's view.
Could I just have a show of hands? I'm losing track of one, two, Ivor. You want to go next?
A review of the actuarial profession should first of all identify what exactly has gone wrong and why exactly it has gone wrong. This the interim assessment fails to do. For example, on whistleblowing. Life assurance company salesmen, with the aid of misleading actuarial illustrations, persuaded millions of pension scheme members to sacrifice their membership in return for a transfer value to a personal pension. The proposal firms flooded in. No attempt was made to provide an actuarial comparison of the benefits given up with the benefits granted on a like-for-like basis. I wrote to the actual advisor, to the Life Assurance and Unit Trust regulatory organisation, Loutro, in 1989, when the mis-selling began. I asked him eventually what Loutro was doing to monitor the situation. The actuarial advisor broke off correspondence. Nothing was done. The consequence of this was the mis-selling scandal with billions of pounds being lost to the consumers. Who regulates the regulators? That's what I would like to know. Now, coming on to the next part, in paragraph 2.12 on page 28 of the Morris Interim Review, respondents felt, this is in quotes, by the way, it is rather a marvellous piece, so I give people time to turn to page 28. It's really excellent. Felt that the provision of traditional advice to define benefit schemes would eventually decline as they are phased out. This is as if Henry VIII, when he was doing a review of the monastic profession, just slipped in, "By the way, I intend to dissolve the monasteries." I mean, well, we really, if this is the case, two-thirds of us here probably wasting our time. Now, the impending demise of all defined benefit schemes, because that's what it says, merits rather more explanation. The cash coming in to pension funds and life assurance long-term funds is used, first of all, to pay benefits. There is usually a considerable excess of net new money to be invested. Unfortunately, there's a dearth of suitable new investments. Most of the net new money is used to buy already existing shares. Market makers have to raise the trading price of shares in order to induce sellers to come into the market. This raises the market capitalization of shares as a whole. Pension fund assets are artificially inflated. Pension scheme actuaries recommend lower contributions to clients. Actual company profits and dividends are unaffected by soaring share prices. Yields go down. Eventually, share prices are seen to be unrelated to future prospects and also go down. Actuaries recommend sharply increased contributions. Employers decide to close pension schemes. That's what's been happening, and it looks like from the review, what I've just quoted, that's what envisages is going to happen. An even worse fate awaits life assurance companies, though this is not dealt with in the review. Equitable Life, lacking the cushion of free assets, was the first to succumb. Life assurance company payouts are based on market values of assets. When the stock market is high, as it still is at present, high life assurance company payouts are made out of incoming cash. In return, incoming and continuing policyholders have a share in assets of doubtful actual value. All appears well while the salesmen are bringing in the cash. However, free assets fell from 34% in 1985 to 6% in 2002. There will come a tipping point when everything will go into reverse. Assets will have to be sold to pay claims. This situation can only be avoided by an early and frank acknowledgement of past and present errors. We do not need flattery, we need a candid friend. I expanded more fully on mis-selling pension funds with profits life assurance and other actuarial matters in my documented typescript evidence to the Morris Review, receipt of which was acknowledged on 28th of July 2004. Unfortunately, my evidence does not appear to have reached the review's website. Thank you.
My name is Robert Steele. At this place, I ought to mention that I'm not a qualified actuary. I'm an old-style associate, which means generally I'm considered an actuarial technician. I also have the distinction, unfortunately, of being probably the most active lay trade unionist in the profession. I wish some others would come and help me. I've got several points I'd like to have made, but some of them have been covered. So I cover the ones that, from my expertise, that I feel that this needed at this stage of the debate. One was that I have been a member of the Pensions National Advisory Committee of MSF, which is now Amicus and used to be ASTMS, to those who need those sort of initials to identify it. About 2 years ago, we debated the need for separate actuarial advice for trustees. I should point out that I was the only actuarial person on the committee. We'd all been appointed by our appropriate regions, and practically every other region had appointed a trustee or ex-trustee of a large pension fund. The general consensus of opinion was not that they needed their own actuary. It's that the members' representatives, and they felt themselves as such, wanted direct and individual access to the current scheme actuary. They actually viewed the actuary as an expert witness to which all sides could interrogate and cross-examine. They didn't think the need. They could then go a higher way and take that evidence to another actuary if they needed. But their initial view was no, just direct access to them. The other point I wish to make is that it actually relates to item 7 on page 2, where it says there is insufficient transparency in actuarial advice. One view of that is, well, let's put all our reports in OHP slides. But the other point is, more seriously, is that we have been giving out advice and people haven't been bothering to look. the first office to actually get into difficulties with falling returns was, in fact, the United Kingdom Temperance and General Provident Institution, or UK Provident, which some 20 years ago was the first office to have to reduce its bonus rates. It then realised it was going to have difficulties, sought a merger, and closed itself to new business. Its DTI returns were one of the first to be produced following the new structure back in 1980, and it was then felt that everyone would want to examine these returns for the new office once it had closed its new business to see what the effect was. So a lot of effort was put into making those one of the most clearest returns. I know I was given the job of actually writing the drafts. All my drafts were checked by the back door, by the government, by independent actors and so on. We introduced, in fact, the first office to bring in a Section 68 order for future profits. I inveigled this to be announced at the annual general meeting of the mutual by actually asking the question, has one been applied for, and was told there was. We needn't have bothered. No so-called expert from the press, from other firms, wanted a copy of those DTI returns. We sat there with boxes waiting for people to come. We ended giving them to policyholders when they came through the door. Basically, there was transparency and not one of the press wanted to answer it. We now have the fact that 20 years later, we have the Times reporting on, oh, a Section 68 order. Oh, that's an accountancy trick. No, it's not. And if you'd got your finger out 20 years ago, we'd have told you what it meant. That, said Derek, is what we're faced with. A press that can't be bothered to do its job properly. That is why, when you look at the equitable, most people here seem to be misinformed. I've had my contribution published in the Times Law Supplement. Nobody else in the Times has even bothered to read it. I've had it published twice in the Actuary. And yet I seem to be about one of the few people that realise it was not because the equitable did not put aside sufficient reserves for the liabilities they identified. It was because the policyholders acquired a benefit that the office hadn't realised they got it.
Stick to the discussion.
I'm just trying to point out to you that this is the background we're faced with. That we, what we really need to do as a profession, in what we have failed to do in the past, we have not fought our corner properly, and that is something we need to do.
Thank you very much. Jeremy Goford. Imagine my frustration when I got this the interim assessment and read the piece which said that regulation is there because there's an element of market failure, and the market failure in the market for actuarial services in the gap in information and understanding exists between the actuarial advisor and the ultimate beneficiary of the advice. And I'd been banging on about customer needs focus and taking into account the interests of the customer in advising the client, and also how an actuary coming across a public interest issue whilst advising the client should construct his or her advice in the business context of the client, and indeed produced two articles, one on the public interest and the individual actuary, and one on the public interest and the profession. So nobody listened, as the previous speaker was also saying. So that was a considerable frustration to me. And then put alongside that statements from Sir Derek that the trustees and non-executive directors particularly find it very difficult to understand actuarial advice and may even have some reluctance to do so, and that this somehow, therefore, Sir Derek is inclined to think that therefore the actuary should have some accountability towards the directly towards the customer or the employee. Now, this is quite contrary to the direction that the FSA is going in, which is saying that it's management's responsibility and the director's responsibility to make decisions and have the relationships with policyholders. So to suggest that actuaries in life companies, because of the complexity of the advice that they give, and the possible lack of understanding of directors to understand actual advice, that therefore there should be some accountability to policyholders, I disagree with. What I'd rather see is to stick with the FSA line, with this very clear distinction that the relationships are between the actuary and his or her client, and the client and policyholders, and not to mix up the two. And hopefully, with the help of the FSA, the behavioural reaction of management will be, how the hell did we ever get into this complex situation in the first place? And why don't we simplify things, A, so that we, the directors and management, can understand, and then, and also policyholders have some hope of understanding too, and lead to a simplification of the whole process. After all, if you do start with customers' needs, the vast, vast, vast majority of those needs can be satisfied by simple benefits, and that a lot of the complexity is actually unnecessary. So then I looked further as to whether we should have any accountability towards policyholders, and Sir Derek in his interim assessment has five criteria of being accountable. One is appointment. Well, we can't be appointed by policyholders. Remuneration. We're not going to be paid by policyholders. Duties. Contractual, tortuous, fiduciary. Maybe there's something in there. Scrutiny. We're not going to be scrutinised by policyholders. And liability. We wouldn't have liability directly to policyholders. So trying to create a direct accountability to policyholders, I think, is fraught with difficulty. So we need to clarify this, perhaps clash between the direction that Sir Derek is pointing and where the FSA is going. Because I also believe that to give unfettered advice to our clients, including pointing out the implications of our advice to our clients for policyholders and employees, that the actuary actually needs to be unfettered from any direct accountability to those employees and policyholders. If we have this direct accountability, I think our advice will be more constrained, more caveated, and less use. And I think actuaries will deliver better quality advice if their advisor relationship is solely with the client, but, as I've said, with the obligation to advise the client what happens if you look at the actuarial advice through the customer's end of the telescope. And I then pick up the previous speaker who wanted access to the actuary as expert witness. And I think if you apply the similar principles where the FSA is going to life companies, to pension funds, so that the employees understand that it's the trustees that they look to, and it's the trustees who are providing the benefits, we can see that it would be inappropriate for employees to have direct access to the actuarial advisers. It's to the trustees they must look for all their explanations. Thank you.
Right, is Ian McKeever here?
My name is Ian McKeever. First, I'd like to say that I've read the report with great interest and been most impressed with much that it contained. So Derek is to be congratulated. This report is tremendously important. Although the actuarial profession is a small one, it is central to the operation of the insurance and pensions industry. One of the most important aspects of the review is the fact that the profession is perceived not to have adequately protected the public interest. The pensions industry is a position where a high proportion of pension schemes have insufficient assets to meet liabilities. The life assurance industry is also not as financially healthy as it might be. It is important in reviewing the profession to understand how this came about and what part the profession played in this. The review specifically refers to the conflicts of interest that arise for the profession. My own experience is with company pensions, and it is an area where conflicts of interest abound. Frequently, those conflicts exist within single individuals or organisations. The company director can be a trustee and a member. All three of these roles have different and conflicting interests. As mentioned in paragraph 30, the actuary has multiple and conflicting roles. He has duties to the trustees, the members, the government, and the profession, while his appointment is generally a matter for the employer. The government's role also has inherent conflicts. It has an interest in protecting the public, but its interests are not necessarily the same as that of the public. It has a financial interest in ensuring a healthy pensions industry in order to reduce its own costs of pension provision in the long term. This conflicts with its desire to reduce the loss of tax revenue in the short term. Long-term benefits have short-term costs and vice versa. Reducing contribution rates in the short term may reduce the employer's immediate costs, but any delay in funding will in the long term increase overall costs overall and not reduce them. One of the most important aspects of this review must be how the profession deals with these conflicts and exactly what its public interest role is. Given this, I would have hoped for the report to concentrate a little more on the role of the professional bodies as opposed to that of individual actuaries. The conflicts of interest that exist for individual actuaries are less sharp for the profession as a body. Although individual actuaries might lose appointments, they were replaced by other actuaries. The professional body is therefore above these issues and is well placed to protect the public interest. I was therefore somewhat surprised to see so little of the interaction between the professional body, so little on the interaction of the professional body with the government, which itself has conflicts of interest, in that its short-term interests may conflict with its long-term interests. More specifically, the profession's role vis-à-vis statutory requirements. The review makes no mention of what role the professional body had or should have in setting these standards. There have been two sets of regulations applying to pension fund scheme funding. The first goes back to the 1980s. These are the surplus regulations, specifically designed to prevent overfunding of pension schemes with a view to limiting the loss of tax revenue to the exchequer. In retrospect, it is possible to see that the profession should have reacted to this and pointed out the risks of adverse economic changes more forcefully. The second is the MFR regulations introduced in 1997, which on the face of it were intended to ensure a minimum level of funds solvency for pension funds. I think it's now generally accepted this minimum standard was in fact too low. Indeed, it could be argued that the MFR regulations had a negative effect on funding levels for many schemes, as it appeared to employers that if they were fully funded on the MFR assumptions, they were adequately funded overall. It certainly weakened the case of any actuary advising a more prudent funding regime. The Institute has recognised this, and successive practice notes have increasingly pointed out that the MFR basis is not sufficient for funding or transfer values. It might be asked whether anybody benefited from the setting of a minimum solvency standard based on optimistic assumptions. On the face of it, no one. However, the Treasury itself might have had an interest in weakening the valuation assumptions for pension schemes. As is pointed out in 136, the government finally removed dividend tax credits in 1997, just when the MFR regulations were introduced. However, previous chancellors have been reducing the level of these tax credits in the period immediately before that. Although the effect of the removal of the tax credits was only to reduce return on equities by something of the order of 0.75% a year, the overall effect of this was to increase the government's tax revenue by an amount some commentators have estimated at $5 billion a year. This figure reflects an enormous size of pension schemes and illustrates their economic importance. The reduction in yield of 0.75% might seem small, but this is only apparent. A reduction in investment return of this order of magnitude is likely to increase the cost of accrued benefits by between a fifth and a third, depending on the scheme benefit structure. From the point of view of the Treasury at the time, the problem was to raise tax revenue without adverse political repercussions. It was therefore in the Treasury's interest that the assumptions underlying pension scheme actuarial valuations remain the same. That way, the additional costs would not become apparent until some years. Introduction of the tax change. Indeed, the
Could you sort of stop giving us a history lesson, please, and move on to something relevant to the report? I know there are other people who want to contribute.
Yes, okay. I simply feel that this is an area that isn't covered in the report. That what we do need to do is consider the profession as a body and its relationship with the government, because I feel that the profession has insufficient input into the regulatory structure.
Thank you.
The report makes much of ensuring best practice is achieved. This does raise a cost issue, which concerns me particularly for small schemes, because the cost of actuarial advice can be significant. Is less significant for the large schemes, which seem to be the main concern of the report. But there are many schemes out there with 50 employees or 50 members, and in those sort of situations, the cost of actuarial advice is significant and may well reduce the amount of money available to provide member benefits, which is, as far as I'm concerned, the most important issue. In any regulatory regime, therefore, I think we need to be very careful that the degree of regulation, the cost of regulation, is proportionate to the situation and doesn't impose excessive costs on schemes or employers.
Right, I think there was somebody in the back corner, was there? Had their hand up? No?
Hi, Joseph Collins. I'd just like to say a few words on the education point, which I think, probably being a younger member, slightly closer to my heart than a few of the other issues. One of the key things that Sir Derek said was he'd like to see a bit more emphasis on university education coming through as some way of having a quicker passing effort and a broadened kind of focus on more actuarial issues than life companies and pension companies were interested in. But I fear that the problem is that people coming out with all these broad kind of jack-of-all-trades actuarial degrees will find it hard then to get employed by these life companies, pension companies, consultancies, whose primary focus are the things they're teaching them at the moment. One of the other problems will be people being trained only in theoretical issues, and having done the exams, there's often a large conflict between theory and what happens in practice. Is there will be another 2-3 years of training time once they get to eventually working for a company, which, and although Derek dismisses this as an irrelevance, the salary structure, when people come out qualified actuaries, they will not want to return to the roles that actuarial students are doing for half the cost. And this is a prime concern of mine, is that if actuarial students are no longer kind of considered valid, the roles they perform, and perhaps perform well but cannot achieve qualification in the harder subjects, they may find their roles devalued and become, you know, less important to a company who feel that there's no importance in training them up because they can import fully qualified actuaries from universities to the higher level roles, and the people doing the base subjects have to stay, don't get rotated, and don't really get treated with the respect they currently do from their employers. Another thing which needs concentration on is the reference to Australia's kind of better education system, because it puts more actuaries into broader roles. That may be a mistake of cause and effect being taken the wrong way around. We have a couple of Australian people in our company at the moment who say that the problem is there aren't enough actuarial roles within the traditional roles, and so this is why there's a broad spread. And perhaps looking just briefly at this, it didn't come across to the Morris kind of team. That's all.
Thank you. No, I believe we've got two people upstairs. A voice from the gods, or two voices from the gods.
Hello, I hope I can be seen from here. Malcolm Small, Deputy Chair of the Investment Life Assurance Group. Mr. President, Sir Derek, I've been very interested by the debate this evening, and I speak as a non-actuary. I am, in fact, a solicitor by training. And one of the things that I would observe, particularly from Jeremy Gofford's speech, is that it is very difficult for senior managers and board members in life insurance companies and pension operations quite often to understand adequately what our actuarial colleagues are saying to us. And I would simply postulate this question. If it is possible for training courses to exist in finance for non-finance managers and in law as law for non-lawyers, I'd very much welcome a course in actuarial sciences for non-actuaries. Thank you.
Thank you. I believe we have another disembodied voice up there. Is that right?
Thank you, Mr. President. My name is Julian Lee. If there's one element of the report that I am concerned about, it is the, as I consider it, excessive accent on the question of reserved roles. These are undoubtedly some of the most important roles that actuaries play, but as the report notes, about a quarter of actuaries hold practicing certificates, which means presumably that three quarters don't. They are doing important work for their employers. It may be that many most important roles, but on the other hand, many senior actuaries have distinguished careers without holding practicing certificates. I think it is important that we recognise that the service that those actuaries give to those who employ them and those to whom they are consultants should get as good a service as those who hold practicing certificates and perform reserved roles. I'd also point out that certainly in general insurance, even those who hold practicing certificates may spend a large majority of their working lives not carrying out reserved roles. It's for this reason that certainly the current proposals on the CPD scheme propose extending the CPD scheme to all actuaries except those who are retired. And I recognise the remarks made earlier by Mr. Martin about possible changes to the current proposals. The review does mention the fact that it's only for reserved role holders that the CPD scheme is compulsory at the moment, but I would point out that all actuaries are encouraged to perform it. I'd also perhaps point out that at Gyro last year there were about 400 attenders, the vast majority of whom were actuaries, certainly over 90%. There are something like 50 holders of Lloyd's practicing certificates, which means that something of the order of 300 people, possibly more, attended that conference without having to, because they presumably were interested in what was going on, and they valued the opportunity to extend their competence and extend their knowledge and extend their current market awareness. So I think that demonstrates that there is a strong commitment to further learning and keeping up with current developments among the profession, even where it's not compulsory. Finally, I'd like to make a few remarks about the extension of reserved roles within general insurance. While I think there were sensible remarks in the report, I think ultimately this is a question for the Financial Services Authority. The Institute and the General Insurance Board has been active in assisting the Financial Services Authority and its thoughts on this matter. But I think ultimately whether there is a reserved role is something that has to be customer-driven, not profession-driven. And certainly it isn't ultimately the profession's decision as to whether this sort of extension is made. Thank you.
One there and then one here.
Thank you. Adrian Waddingham. Many pension schemes do use more than one consultancy for several services and would oppose any restrictions on unbundling. And I'm very glad that Sir Derek has not found any evidence of formal ties imposed by firms when bundling services. I'm sure they don't exist. Now, as Sir Derek has said, the actuarial world is a competitive one, and in a free market, users will look to suppliers of services to offer services they require, including bundle services with a view to simplifying management and reducing costs. As has been pointed out already, consulting actuaries see considerable merit in the same experienced eyes looking at both pension scheme liabilities and assets, and there are other examples which suggest that it will very often be quite appropriate for the actuary to provide advice to trustees and the company. A simple example is, of course, the provision of FRS 17 accounting figures to a company are easily and least expensively provided by the scheme actuary to the trustees. And this is common sense. And it is, of course, up to the users who choose to buy into bundled services that they consider what they gain and lose from accepting a bundled package. But it would be a nonsense in a competitive market if consulting actuaries were restricted from offering what are complementary services. It would also be anti-competitive to restrict users from taking bundled packages. On another point, Sir Derek and other commentators have perhaps made a little too much of the understanding gap between users of actuarial services and their advisors. It's important for all advisors, all specialists, not just actuaries, to be able to communicate with their clients. And actuaries, like medics or engineers, know that solutions to real problems do need to be presented clearly, not in a way that adds to confusion. This is the mark of a good consultant in any profession, and we have many good consultants, and indeed many of the firms spend considerable time and effort on developing communication skills within their own firms. And it's also important to recognize that many users, particularly those with limited resources, those based in small, medium-sized businesses, will have limits to the level of understanding that they wish to reach. Now, in those cases, as with other professionals, it's important that users feel confident in the advice their actuaries are giving through the strength of their professional standards so that they can be trusted. And again, this is an area where Sir Derek's review is most helpful in the recommendations intended to strengthen the actuarial standard-setting process. Finally, actuaries take pride and no little credit for the British pensions habit, and actuaries mourn more than anyone, and not for selfish reasons, the demise of good schemes by misguided regulation. I hope this point isn't lost.
Mr. President, Sir Derek, Mike Ermston. I'd like to sort of echo some points that Seamus made a little bit earlier. There is an unwritten question here in the hall today, which is, what is the future for this profession? And I think we need to consider very carefully what it is. Is it a vibrant, growing profession, or is it one which is going to decline in the future with the decline of with-profits and defined benefit pension schemes? It seems to me that this is a bit of an opportunity to pick up that report and move the profession forwards. And I am a bit concerned that there are sections in the report which focus more about what actuaries can't do rather than what they can do and the areas that they can develop into. And I think that needs to be taken on board. I think the proposals around education start to do that, and I would thank you for those. But I think allowing actuaries and building actuaries to build careers in many different areas of the UK economy is something that the report should take on board. Thank you.
Thank you. One there, Cliff, sir. Thanks.
Hi, Mike Harrison.
A few things have been said about conflict of interest, and I wasn't going to speak, but I do have a fairly strong opinion on it, so I thought I'd throw my two penneth in. I read somewhere recently that sex falls into two categories. There's sex for free and sex for money, and the difference between the two is that sex for free is ultimately much more expensive. I think if the categorisation, if I can dare to follow up an analogy, the categorisation is analogous to the position we find ourselves in as members of the actuarial profession, in particular in my role as a pension scheme actuary, subject to unavoidable conflicts of interest, in particular the conflict of interest where I advise the trustees of a pension scheme as well as the sponsoring employer. For years, we've effectively given our clients, if you like, a free ride or a significantly discounted ride by changing the element of prudence we incorporate in evaluation basis according to the level of client pressure. I find it very difficult to sensibly advise trustees as long as I have that pressure, because I also have to advise the sponsoring employer. A lot of people might believe that the pressure to adopt different assumptions might be less now that we have market-based funding methodologies, and most people have moved in that direction. But the ability to smooth valuation results and give an answer that the client might want is still very, very broad. Just to give one example, by adopting or not adopting new mortality tables as published by the CMI, you could change the value placed on liabilities of a pension scheme by 20% or more. I would very much like you, Sir Derek, not to shirk from jumping all the way to option 4 with regard to conflicts of interest for pension scheme actuaries and saying that the same actuary cannot advise the trustees and the employer at the same time. I'm quite happy with the Paul Thornton suggestion that you could have two separate actuaries in the same company, and there is no reason, as an earlier speaker mentioned, that the cost should be significantly higher. But please, can we have two separate actuaries to avoid that conflict of interest that arises for me as a practicing scheme actuary and for other people who I work with and other people I know in other firms? If I can dare to just go back to my analogy again, there's a couple of good advantages of the sex for money model. One of them is that everybody clearly understands the risk. And the other is that however clever your smoothing techniques, at the end of the night, you have to have market consistent pricing. That's all on conflict of interest. I just did have some thoughts as well on education. A number of times through the section on education, you mentioned how we've been slow to respond to certain changes and new methodologies, in particular financial economics. But you then don't seem to make the intuitive leap to saying, therefore, actuaries who are now qualified should have to study financial economics and show that they understand it. So we brought it into the syllabus, but for CPD, you're saying you accept the Institute changes with only a few minor tweaks, yet there's nothing in your review or in the Institute changes that says, for example, a pension scheme actuary cannot remain a pension scheme actuary unless they have passed an examination in financial economics. And I think we should all have to do that to continue to practice, say, within 5 years. I think that probably brings me to a close. Thank you very much.
There's one down here. Margaret, there's one down here. This is going to be the man who sets the financial economics test. Yeah.
Thank you. And thank you for the work to date, Cliff Speed. I'd like to address my remarks to Actuarial Standards Board and standard setting. First of all, even if there is an independent oversight body such as the FRC, I would still advocate significant lay membership of an Actuarial Standards Board. Essentially, I think the profession is too small and too insular, notwithstanding the good remarks made by Chris Norton earlier. In support of this, I note that the drive to realistic reporting on the life side came primarily from the FSA and not from the profession. And similarly, the widely applauded new pensions accounting standard, FRS 17, came from the ASB. If we look at standard setting, I want to return to a theme which has been debated often in this hall, the use of discount rates and whether we make additions or subtractions to them. Now, we know from outside the profession that it is standard procedure in financial risk management that if the collateral you have to meet a liability is mismatched, then you need more assets, not less. However, within the profession, whether you need more assets or less depends upon the area you're practicing. Now, this is something which is not shades of grey, this is black and white. Both cannot be correct. So maybe there's a challenge for the profession here. If we can demonstrate we have clear, consistent standards across the areas we practice, we surely are demonstrating that we are responsible to take a major role in setting the standards which we all must abide by going forward. Finally, a smell test. I often come across the words long term. They're never well defined, but also it seems to suggest the normal rules of financial management can sometimes be set aside. Now, I can think of other areas of financial practice where the valuation of liabilities does not matter if that liability extends 6 months or 50 years, the same rules apply. I think we ought to treat the terms long term with caution. Thank you.
Somebody else upstairs?
Did that come through? I take in the Morris team's positive comment. I take heart in the Morris team's positive comments about the work and professionalism of actuaries. And I also note with interest their observation that actuarial advice is not fully understood. I think these two together have potential ramifications on the scope of the reserved roles for actuaries. I question whether these should not be widened rather than narrowed. For example, had a professional diligent actuary or person like an actuary been personally responsible for the way life assurance products were advertised in the office's literature and the conduct of the marketing, then I wonder whether the pension mis-selling scandals that we saw would have occurred. Perhaps marketing compliance should be a reserved role for a professional person, and then who better than the people who fully understand the way the products were priced and designed. As another example, We now have life companies having to formally value on their balance sheets the embedded option for investment guarantee liabilities. I wonder who is best placed to advise life companies how to invest assets supporting these liabilities. This is indeed a specialist area, which not all actuaries are specialists in, but there certainly are a growing number. While I support the FSA's move towards a multidisciplinary team on the board, this is not necessarily incompatible with more reserved roles for professionals in their field. I hope we move forward with technologically advanced products with valuable guarantees, which are valuable to our customers, managed using modern option pricing methods instead of the pre-House of Lords method, like within the US industry, and not like the simpler road that the Australian industry has taken. This is important if the UK insurance and pension industries will now move forward vibrantly. On the subject of education, the maintenance of professional standards will be key. Thank you.
Well, it's now 5 to 7, so I think as a courtesy I would like to offer Sir Derek the opportunity if he wants to say a few words to close up.
Thank you. There are obviously many things I could say to many of the points raised, but I think that's not appropriate tonight. Let me just try and answer one question, though, that was raised earlier on, which was about the interim review not being clear on what responses we had received from various user groups with whom we had a series of meetings. Those groups were life company non-executives, sponsor companies for pension schemes, and trustees. These were a series of meetings rather than written submissions, and that's the only reason that perhaps there is less clarity in the report on what responses we got than is the case with written submissions. If I could give you a very quick summary of what we were told, there was perhaps the most satisfaction with the present arrangements, perhaps not surprisingly, I don't know, from sponsor companies. The response was mixed. Some felt that they could usefully get more advice, more discussion of the advice that was given, more clarity and so on. But many felt that really there was not, at least not a systemic problem here. There was a much less sanguine response from the other two groups. Quite a number of trustees were very concerned, not all, but and indeed some trustees, of course, had significant expertise in this area. But the general picture from trustees was that they did find it very difficult to discharge their responsibilities. And that's partly because of the difficulty of not so much understanding what they were told, but understanding enough that they knew what questions and what probing they ought to be imposing on the actuary who gave them that advice. So knowing what to ask, really. And in one or two cases, I don't want to rely too much on anecdote, but this, I think, was quite telling, and others there felt that this was not an extreme case, where a scheme actuary would have been advising for a large number of years, certainly over 10 years, maybe longer, and then retired. And because they retired, a new scheme actuary came in. And only at that point were they advised that quite a lot of the advice that they'd been receiving prior to that point was really out of date, was insufficient, was, frankly, in some cases, poor. Others here may know of similar stories. I don't know. The worry from my perspective was, why wasn't that picked up earlier? Why wasn't there some mechanism through scrutiny, through peer review, through greater clarity from the actuary, through non-compliance with standards? I don't know. There's a number of ways in which one could cut that, but why wasn't it clear long before this actuary retired that the user was not getting best advice? And a rather similar sort of picture emerged from non-execs on life companies. They find it difficult to discharge their responsibilities. Now, I can't say I know what the answer to this is. I wish I did. But it does seem to me that part of it must lie with user skills and user training, and indeed with company management responsibility. But I don't think I can accept the argument that, as it were, actuaries have no wider role than simply to meet their customers' needs, and if their customers appear happy and don't want to change them, then there's no further problem. I don't think that's sustainable, and I don't think the public would accept that as a proposition. Part of the element of concern by some of the less skilled users, trustees, non-execs, was that, how shall I put it? They got point answers. Here was a figure, a value for liabilities. Now, if there's a... I mean, I think this is a fairly basic proposition. If a user is given a single figure, then there has to be a degree of risk attached to that. Now, of course, that risk might be zero, but it's unlikely. And what users often felt they simply did not know was the degree of risk that was attached to any particular figure. In other words, there may have been the introduction of stochastic techniques and so on, and actually coming up with, on a basis of a set of assumptions, probability distributions, and you can cut the tail at various points. But that sort of picture of the degree of risk entailed in any particular set of figures, and this, of course, can relate to the asset side as well, was something that they didn't feel they had got a grasp on. Now, that's partly their fault, but I think part of that must be about how actuaries convey what they need to convey, which is the degree of risk and uncertainty about the future, not just point estimates. Now, as I say, there are many other things I could respond on, but I hear the clock chiming. I hope that that does fill in some of the concerns that key users were feeding to us and which have informed, I hope productively, the interim report. Thank you.
Thank you, Sir. I'd like to start my closing remarks with an apology. When I listed the guests who were here this evening, I omitted one. And I omitted him because I see him almost every day, and I forgot that he was here as a guest tonight. This is, of course, Harvey Brown, president of the faculty. Harvey, you're most welcome. I said at the beginning that our view on councils was that the report, the interim assessment by Sir Derek Morris and his team, was both balanced and fair. And I think those of you who've heard him tonight will realise that he's not only balanced and fair in his written comments, but also an extremely reasonable, balanced and fair man in the flesh. So, Derek, we are most grateful to you, firstly, for the cooperation we've had during the course of your review so far, which we trust will continue to its completion and maybe even beyond. And we're also extremely grateful to you and your team for coming along tonight. I think we've heard a wide range of views on a whole raft of different subjects. I won't attempt to summarise any of them. I'm tempted to add my own two, Penneth, but since we're after 7 o'clock, I won't. But can I ask you all, on behalf of the profession, to thank Sir Derek for coming along tonight. It would be very helpful for those preparing the transcript of the discussion if any of you who spoke and who've got prepared notes could hand them to either Pauline Simpson or Maria Lyons, the back of the hall, as you leave. The next sessional meeting of the Institute of Actuaries will take place on Monday, 28th of February, when a discussion on current developments in embedded value reporting is scheduled to take place. We now, as is customary, invite you to join us for a drink, but we have some logistics to achieve. Could I ask the people sitting in the council chamber at the back, please, to push their seats to the side to clear a space for drinks? Would those of you seated here in the council chamber just hang on until that's been done? If those of you in the back half could then go into the council chamber, we'll whip those chairs away, and then those of you in the front half can go and we can use the hall as well as the council chamber. If that's not too complicated, I declare the meeting closed.